Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Welcome to Listen to Older Voices. I'm Rob Greaves, and it's my pleasure to introduce the third and final part of the story of 65-year-old Lindsay Field. Born in New Zealand, Lindsay had supportive and encouraging parents and a fantastic childhood. It was as a young boy that he first experienced an attack of Bell's palsy, a medical complaint that would affect him again in later life. School awoke a love for music in him, and so it was that eventually Lindsay applied to join the smash hit musical Hair. He was successful and moved to Sydney to commence a whole new lifestyle, often indulging in all manner of social activities, but surely and slowly awakening his spiritual side. This week, we learn how Bell's palsy brought his successful time with Hair to an end, but in itself, this eventually led to his journey of self-discovery deepening. As the story unfolds, we realise there's a depth and a gentleness to this man that has set him on a lifelong journey of self-discovery whilst not isolating himself from society. There are so many stories to engage us, so let's pick up with Lindsay talking about the rather strange meeting he had with a Buddhist monk whilst working with Hair.
I was always checking things out. I mean, I remember that when we were in Auckland with Hair, there was some Buddhist monk who was up in the hills just out of Auckland. I can't remember what they called it, a Buddhist retreat thing. And, you know, he was sitting in this window and in a long queue of people were going up and asking him questions and things like that, you know, and I didn't know what to ask. So I'd sort of walked up to him and he sort of looked at me sagely and said, "You need to learn to meditate." And I'm going, "Well, spell yak."
Good response.
I know that. "Can you teach me?" And he said, "You must go and prepare yourself." And I'm going, myself for what?
Yeah.
I had no idea what was, you know, what do you do? You know, I'd become a vegetarian. I was
trying everything.
Yes. And at the end of that 6 weeks, I think we were in New Zealand. We went back and we my contract was up.
Oh, okay.
So yep. I didn't want to sign another contract, but I didn't know what else to do. And there were no signs for me. So I signed another contract. We went to Sydney and we had this party that lasted for 3 days. It just was, you know, you just imbibed and everything and then fell over and then got up and started again. Yep. And then it's the first time I'd ever had pain associated with Bell's palsy, but I just ended up having this fearsome pain in my head, and my face started to drop, and I knew what was happening, and so I knew that my contract was going to be null and void because it would be at least 3 months before I could work again. And you know, I went to see a naturopath in Sydney, some famous German guy, and he sort of was looking in my irises and shining a torch, and he just got very, very angry and threw me out. And he said, you're so toxic. Your body is so full of toxins. How do you expect me to do anything with this? Get out."
Great. He only wants to heal the healthy, does he?
And so I came to Melbourne. And I had a very dear friend of mine, Rod Mulliner, who's an actor and a voiceover artist, and his wife, Penny, who we sadly lost a few years ago, was in Hair with me. And so they lived up in Kew. He was making a television series at the time called Ryan. And Pamela Stevenson was his sidekick, and they lived in this house in Kew. I lived under the laundry sink in the back laundry. And one day this guy turns up, and his name is Laurie Maund, and he was the assistant stage manager for Hair. And it was quite early in the morning, and he said to me, I've come to take you somewhere. And I said, "Oh, okay." You know, I got up and I had my white Indian kurta and pants on, cotton pants and stuff, you know, sandals.
Yeah.
We were quite a hippie at this stage. And he took me to this house in Carlton. And I walked in and I saw a girl who subsequently became my first wife, Kim O'Leary, who was in Hair with me. And Kim was a real anarchist in those days. And I just saw this woman and she completely transformed. She was a totally different, just glowing human being. And I walked upstairs and there was on the mantelpiece in this room of this terraced house in Carlton was this huge photo of a 14-year-old boy, Indian boy, whose name was known then as Guru Maharaji. And I was like, oh, what's this? And Laurie's mourned, it's just dropped me that I said, are you not coming? He said, no, I've got something else to do. And I didn't see him again for more than 20 years when Julie and I went to Thailand and we ran into him up in the north of Thailand where he was running a heritage place. He's a wonderful man, another story. Yeah. And there was this guy in saffron robes with a shaved head, Indian, called Mahatma Guru Chanananda. Subsequently, and still a very dear friend of mine and a beautiful man. And I just listened to him speak and he wasn't saying anything that I didn't know. But I just said, my initial feeling was that, you know, God or whatever that entity is speaking to me through this human being. And then he said, okay, who would like to receive this knowledge? I'm going, what the hell is he talking about? And he said, and everybody's putting their hands up. So I put my hand up, crossed my fingers behind my back, put the other hand, thinking, well, if this is it, I'm home and hosed. If it's not, it's one more place.
Yeah.
I know I don't have to look.
Yeah.
And so he said, we'll come back tomorrow. So we came back the next day and, you know, he said, this knowledge is something that's within inside of you. It just needs to be revealed. The door just needs to be opened. And, you know, that's what the master is there to do. That's his gig. That's his job. He said, I am his servant or whatever. I am his Mahatma. And, so I've been deputized to do this. This is my job. And so that, I think, was the 12th of October, 1972.
Wow, you remembered that clearly.
Oh, absolutely. Because I sat there and of course I've got Bell's palsy, so my one eye doesn't shut. So I'm sitting there with what you said, just sit and close your eyes, and I've got this one eye shut. So somebody was dispatched to go and find a Band-Aid, so we taped it shut. Dear me. But, you know, during my whole, I guess the transcendental experiences that I'd had that were drug-based were all very spectacular, huge,
yes,
mind-blowing things. This was something that was so subtle and so powerful that it just felt like the whole universe was saying to me, this is truth. I didn't even need affirmation,
yep.
Actually. It was just, that's what it was. It's like the whole world that I'd ever looked at was being played out on a gossamer screen, and it's that these gossamer things parted, and the experience that I had is I'm still there today.
I was going to say, as you're telling the story, it seemed to me that there would be at least a twofold response. One would be a total life journey, that is, the changes are going to keep evolving as you grow older. You know, it's been a change in your life, and as you said, gentle but powerful, which is more evolutionary than revolutionary, which was the big chemical thing.
Mm.
But how did it affect you in the immediate term in terms of the fact that you really were at loss as to where you were going to go next, what you were going to do? Did it have help there?
Yes, because I became much more open to life itself, I think. Half of my problem was that I couldn't see for looking.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of misconceptions, and you know, there's lots of Indianness around it in those days,
of course,
because that's where it had come from. That's yep. where it originated. So there were lots yep. of trappings that have subsequently fallen away, and you're just left with the experience. And so I can remember walking outside afterwards, and there was this mad Frenchman who had been in an earlier session, and he looked at me and he said, Blazer, what a beautiful third eye you have. And I'm going, I must have missed something because I can't see anybody's third eyes. And so I'm walking around staring at people's foreheads thinking, where is it, you know?
It's gone.
And it took a while for me to figure out that, hang on, it's got nothing to do with all of that crap.
Yep, that's right.
And that was part of that evolution. So, but very shortly after that, there was a festival being held in India. And it was an actual chartered jumbo jet full of Australians that went to attend festival.
Okay.
And then we stayed 6 weeks in India at an ashram in Hardwar in UP province, northern India. It's where the Ganges comes out of the foothills of the Himalaya. It was a very transformative time. I was going through a lot. I was learning a lot. I was understanding a lot. I was just, you're adopting concepts, and then next day you're casting them aside because you realise that the experience tells you otherwise. We laugh a lot because when we're faced with insurmountable tasks, I always just look at it and go. There's a saying that I use, and what originated because I was given a task in this ashram in Hardwar, and it was hot. It was in the winter, but still very hot here. And I had to move a big pile of bricks. And so I was there, and I was sweating like a pig, and I worked out a way to... The pile only had to move about, 25 feet. And so I was flicking the bricks with backspin so they all stuck on the pile, didn't bounce off. And this Indian guy comes up to me, and he's sort of got this beautiful look in his eye, and he just walks up to me, and he goes, "Brotherji, what are you doing?" And I said, "I'm moving the bricks, mate." And then sweat's pouring off me, and I'm sort of like exhausted. And he just went, "Ah." And he just looked at me and smiled, and he bent down, he picked up two bricks, and he walked over, put them on the pile, walked back, sort of jiggling his head, smiling at me, picked up two more bricks, walked back, put them on the pile, came back, and he had this, this beautiful smile. And he just looked at me and he said, "Two hands, two bricks." And again, that's 1972.
Yep.
And, if I'm faced with the ironing or any task, and it's like, holy shit,
yeah.
There's this little echo in two the back. Hands, just two goes, bricks. Two hands, two bricks. That the most important thing to be dwelling on is the experience of life. That the physical actions that you're performing are relatively immaterial. If you hold on to that core, life is beautiful. And that's been the essence of my life ever since, in a way, when I'm singing, whether it be music or whatever actions.
People listening are going to probably largely relate to what you're saying, but I'm sure many of them are thinking, that's all well and good, but how did you survive? How did this help you deal with the day-to-day things that you need to do in terms of work and generating an income? How did that help you with that? How did you get your life back together in terms of surviving?
In my case, I was always music-oriented.
So you kept the music focus at that stage?
Yes, yeah. So I ended up playing music. We had a little group with... I'm just trying to think of the chronology of it. I used to do street theatre.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, we went to the Nimbin Festival, the original Nimbin Festival. Oh, dear. But we had this four of us in this little group. We used to travel around in a Volkswagen combi van that belonged to a very dear friend of mine. And we would just do street theatre. Apropos the message that we were trying to spread, which was this message of peace and harmony, and also the message of that there is a knowledge within a human being that is knowable, that can be experienced, and we would just live on the smell of an oily rag. We once broke down in Narrandera and ended up busking in the pub just to get enough money to eat, but fortunately we had music, and there were just various, I suppose, tangents happen. My life's been a lot of tangents where you just veer off in another direction. But this was more of an evolution, though. I think once I'd hit that space, we had a band called Rhythm and Bliss, which was Trevor Wilson from the Lardy Dars was playing bass, Joe Crichton was playing guitar, I was playing guitar and singing, and a guy called Alan Carroll, who was a drummer from Queensland. And we used to play at the Cabbage Patch, we toured, we were doing gigs. I lived hand to mouth, as most musicians were, regardless of
that. And still do, largely.
Attitude, yes. That took us going for a while. That band sort of ended up morphing into a band called One Foundation with Ross Hannaford And by this stage, Joe had become the bass player because Trevor Wilson had decided he didn't want to play bass anymore. So they switched, and much to my horror, and I was mortified because but it proved to be the right decision. And Joe's a wonderful bass player and
yes.
beautiful singer. And Jeff Bridgeford playing drums, who was at XBG's, and Kim, my ex-wife, singing.
Oh, okay.
I sang as well.
Right.
Joe sang.
Right.
And Ross, of course, sang. I mean, that was a very interesting time because Ross is a very dear, dear human being. And he was the one who taught me feel. He woke me up to what feel was in music. We'd only ever played one gig together, which was we'd rehearsed for at his house in Paran. He had this big old house that he lived in, and he was trying to teach us how to play reggae music, you know, and I was just playing these sort of mechanical offbeats, you know, and I didn't get it. And for 3 days, you know, and there was a haze of smoke in the room, of course, and then on the third day, something just clicked, and it was like,
the rhythm.
I could feel it in my breath. And it was like, holy shit, I didn't know this was there.
Yes.
You know, because all the time I'd been trying to create it rather than understand that it already was there in the pulse of the music, the pulse of the essence of the song. And when I got home, to my amazement, I was putting on all this music, to different sorts of music, and listening to it, and it wasn't just reggae music, it was in any music.
Yes.
And even classical music, I was going, wow. And I've always said to Ross, you know, I'll forever be in his debt for that gift that he gave me. And, you know, I still am. I still am because it, again, to me, it's about connecting to the heart. And it took me a very roundabout way to learn all of these lessons, to understand that that's what I was doing in music, and that's what my task was in music, and that's what my goal was to be connected. Everything pointed towards that.
Now, our time isn't up, but it is coming towards it up, and there's no way we can cover your life in 1, 2, or even 3 hours. But it's very interesting that you're talking then about the importance of the rhythm and how it's made a lot more sense to you then. And you're still playing today, but I'd like to just go back a little bit to the work you've done in helping others with their music. Because recently you were working with young people on a talent show, is that not right?
Yes.
How did that come about, and what did that involve?
Well, I was asked to do it, basically. It was to be the head vocal coach for The Voice Kids. And I have mixed feelings about those sort of shows, but the fact that I would be working with 8 to 14-year-olds won it for me. And it was about letting them find something in themselves. Because another thing my father always used to say to me was to lead from behind. He said, always let everybody else think they're doing it. Let them have the kudos. Just as long as you know that the job's done, that's enough. So with children, you know, and I mean, they just do it inherently. They're such open-hearted creatures. And it's wonderful, because I even to the people that I coach now, I say to them, look, as a singer, what your goal is to touch people's hearts. But the only heart you have access to is your own. And so if you can manage to touch your heart, you will naturally touch the hearts of others. And I said, but the only way you can touch your heart is to let go, because you can't buy your way in, you can't earn your way in, you can't chop your way in, carve, dig, delve, whatever. There's only one way you can get into the heart, and that's to let go, because that's naturally where the center of a human being is. And one woman commented to me once when she said, I love coming to Farnham shows. I said, I watch you in the Farnham shows. And he said, you just look like you're somewhere else. And I just laughed. I said, I probably am. Mm. You know, because it's not about being on the stage. It's not about whether there's 14,000 people or 4 people. You know, it's about being in that place, finding that space, because my reward comes from that experience. It doesn't come from the punters.
Was the experience working with the kids rewarding then?
Oh, fantastic. They were lovely. I had nothing to do with the judges.
What about parents? Did you have to
very
do
little.
Them?
Only if there was a problem.
Right.
And there were very few of those. And the parents, they trusted me. The kids trusted me. My peers trusted me. My bosses trusted me to do what I did, you know, like it was, so it was exhilarating because you just got onto this adventure ride with these wonderful little singers.
And what were the age groups that you
eight to 14.
Okay. And in your mind, putting aside the judges, did you see talent?
Yeah, of course, heaps of it. Heaps of it, you know, going on averages, and you know, probably 5% of them will have anything to do with the music industry.
Of course.
But it doesn't matter as long as they've sung, yes. As long as they've had the experience. And that was the whole thing. There was a very high duty of care, of course, because you're working with children and you're required to by law, but that's probably why they haven't done the show again, because they need so many producers to be on site and on hand that it's very expensive to do. The outgoings are enormous. Just to make sure the kids are looked after, protected, nurtured, and so, you know, my job was pretty easy, and I found coaches in each of the states to look after the various kids in each place, but then I'd see them all when I travelled around, or before they did the audition, I'd see each one of them individually and be able to talk to them, and we had a connection. They're not stupid. They feel, and I think just as the evolution of human beings takes place, they're much more aware than we were at that age, in the same way that we were a lot more aware than our parents were.
Yes,
at their age. Yes. That evolution didn't stop with us just because we were the baby boomers. No. We were just, you know, it's like you throw out a flag on a journey and say, oh, baby boomer, but the journey continues.
Yes. The journey does continue, as you said, and so we look into the future. Now, you've got children, and they're growing up now, or getting to that point. Maybe one day there'll be grandchildren. Do you look into the future and fear for them in any way?
No, because I have faith in life itself. I guess my experience of life is such that I think the inherent goodness in humanity and in human beings will win out.
Even in light of the terrible issues we face today with radicalization of adults and children, you think we will see our way through that?
Yes. That's only a result of ignorance. And ignorance, in a way, is exactly what it is. It's ignorance. It's, you know, it's like darkness. Darkness is not in of itself self-existent. It's merely the absence of light. And so ignorance is just the absence of knowledge. And so if you look at it as a linear journey, sure, it looks pretty, you know, fearsome, but it's not linear. Our lives aren't linear. No. When your consciousness changes, suddenly it's like, this is a different ball game. And it's only because people can't see that they behave in the appalling manner that they do.
Now, we sit here together and I look at you and I think I see a very healthy person. I mean, obviously, as each of us get older, we have our little bits and pieces fall off along the way. But all things being equal, you've still got many years of life left.
Well, I hope. Children hope so.
Yeah. For yourself, when you look into the future, where do you see your journey going? Do you look into the future, or do you just take it one day at a time now?
I don't really look into the future. Of course, there are things that, you know, we aspire to do. You know, we want a new bathroom, da 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 da. There are things, nitty gritty stuff, but those are things. In terms of, it's an interesting thing you say that, because lately, you know, I've been not feeling my age, although some parts of my body are wearing out. My knees are terrible, but I feel like I'm at a stage in my life where I'm much more contemplative about things. Where it's not so much a time for reflecting, but it's about consolidating the knowledge that I do have and embracing that more. So it's almost like focusing more on the experience that I'm having rather than getting involved in the minutiae of everything around me. So it's interesting, because I always used to sort of see those things where people define life into four stages, and I can't even remember what the stages are or what their names are, but, you know, I can't remember dates either. So what the hell? But I definitely feel like in 65 years of age that I'm now looking at things in a more measured way. I'm not looking for the kicks anymore. It's much more about a continuum. and strengthening that feeling of a continuum rather than having spikes.
Yeah.
But just, yep. It's almost like the river's broadening, and I want to feel the solidity and the strength of that.
Lindsay, I think you've given people listening a lot to think about, both in terms of their own lives and the issues as you've put them on the table during our hour together. There's no way we could cover your life story in such a short time, but what we have got is a very interesting snapshot of the things and the issues and the times that were important to you. And I just want to thank you very much for sharing them with everybody in the program and for being on Listen to Older Voices. So thank you very much, Lindsay.
It's my pleasure, Rob.
As we finish up, let's share a piece of music that features Lindsay singing and was recorded at a recent live show.
I did my best, wasn't much. I couldn't feel, so I tried to touch. I've told the truth, I didn't come to fool you.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.